It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
In a park in Bacup, Lancashire, England, on the night of August 11, 2007, 21-year-old Sophie Lancaster and boyfriend Robert Maltby were savagely attacked by five teenage boys, aged 14 to 17. They were attacked simply because they dressed differently. Sophie had been attacked after trying to protect her boyfriend and was pulled from life support 13 days later. Robert survived with numerous serious injuries. The first journalist on the scene, Catherine Smythe, provides a dramatic perspective to the case as a mother and a member of the media who became inextricably involved in the story forever. The book chronicles the attack, the town where it happened, the court case, the national and international media interest, and the launch of the Sophie Lancaster Foundation. It also uncovers some anomalies. The police admitted initially attending the wrong park. The ambulance service has yet to explain why it took 14 minutes for first paramedics to reach the scene just a mile away. The book that we're featuring today is the Sophie Lancaster story with my special guest journalist and author, Catherine Smythe. Welcome to the program and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Catherine Smythe.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you very much. Incredible story. Let's get to an introduction. We're talking about Bacup, Lancashire, England. So tell us, for our audience, where exactly this is and describe Bacup. And then we can talk about your background that brought you to this case and like I said, inextricably
Bacup
involved with this case forever.
Bacup is quite a small town. It's on the outskirts of Rossendale. Rossendale is made up of five small towns. They were all clubbed together to when they decided to have an MP for the area. And although the individual towns at one stage had their own municipal authorities, they were all combined to form Rossendale Council, and Bacup is part of that. That is, in turn, is part of Lancashire, which is a much larger county, stretching quite a distance from Rossendale is the furthest east and then right the way through to Blackpool. So you can imagine quite a different area and quite different areas, quite different sizes of areas. We've got cities, towns, but Rossendale, of all of the whole of Lancashire, is probably one of the smallest areas.
Now, tell us a little bit about your background as a journalist and how you came to be involved with this case.
Well, my first job as a reporter in the Rossendale Valley, covering, and at that time it's called Ramsbottom, that was in 1988. From being a reporter in Rossendale, I got work for an evening newspaper, and after having children, went full back to working for my original newspaper, Rossendale Free Press, at the time when Sophie and Rob were attacked. At that time, I was not actually on call, but because I lived in the same area where this attack took place, somebody contacted me on the Sunday evening to tell me that something had happened in the park. So as a result, because I'm a journalist and obviously I'm nosy, I chose to walk to go out of the park that night. I took my young son. We went in the car. As far as he was concerned, we were just going to play. But really, I was going to try and see if there was anything that I could find. So that's the reason why they've said I was the first journalist on the scene, because I knew about it before the police had made any kind of releases to the media.
Now, before we get to August 11, 2007, in this Stubbly Park, let's talk about sort of the incidents and of this. What kind of place is Bacup in terms of violence, in terms of gangs, in terms of teenagers running amok? What's its incidents? What's it really like there previous to this?
Prior to this, Bacup always had a little bit of a dubious reputation. Don't get me wrong, there are some incredibly good people in Bacup, just as there are in every town. But unfortunately, there always seems to have been a problem causing trouble, making life difficult for business owners, showing disrespect to people in the community. And it's very sad that is obviously how a lot of people have interpreted the town. Unfortunately, there was also, probably more so then than now, a great degree of intolerance regarding people of different colours. Black people in the town were few and far between. It was seen as a place where it was almost like whites only at one stage. Things have evolved a little bit, but still to this day, compared to the other towns in Rossendale, there is a very, very small percentage of minority ethnic origin people.
Well, you write in your book that that other communities in the area are about 90% white, which is, I thought, interesting and surprising, but yet Bacup is even more so white. Didn't you say 98% in the book?
That's the data that I could obtain at the time, yes. It would be slightly, but it's still the majority of people. Yes, even though obviously in Rottenstall and Haslingden, we've got mosques, but in Bacup, it's a totally different generic.
Now, you had just spoken about getting the call from your friend that lives in the area, and you went as a reporter and as a... So tell us more about the call and what you did learn at the scene of the... when you did arrive.
The call quite literally just said that there's been something going on in the park. My friend described to me seeing men in white overalls. Now, I'd been a journalist for far too many years not to know that that was scenes of crime officers, and that meant it was incredibly serious. When I got to the park, my initial walk through, because obviously I was, as I said, being nosy and decided to go and have a look. My initial walk through the park took me straight past the skate park, but I noticed nothing. There was no tape. There was nothing at that scene to have indicated that that was where anything had happened. I proceeded to go through the rest of the park. It's an absolutely beautiful park, Stubberley. You have a series of steps that go down towards a beautiful little waterfall that runs along the bottom. It's called Fairy Dale. It is a lovely area, but there was no indication that anything had gone that quieter than I had been before, at other stages, at other times. It was a lot quieter than when I'd seen. Usually there would be quite a few children on the skate park. I don't recall seeing anyone on the skate park that night. And as I walked through the rest of the park, again, the whole area did seem quieter than expected. There was no sign of any police involvement, no sign of any, even police tape that had been ripped down. There was just nothing. So at that stage, I didn't know where the incident had taken place other than somewhere in the park.
Now, you were a news editor of the Rossendale Free Press at that time, but yet the next morning, August 13th, you found out information via the BBC. Tell us what you heard that morning.
When I woke up that morning, I always would wake up to the radio. So BBC Radio Lancashire was playing, and the first item on the news was that there'd been an attack in the park and two people had been left seriously injured. At that stage, they were only describing it as a mob attack, and the information we got through was exactly the same at the office. It was a message that had been left on the police news line, which is an accessible number for journalists so that they can obtain news about what's going on rather than having to keep hassling who communications. The information was very lacking in description other than to say the name of the park, which obviously I'd confirmed what I knew from the day before, and the fact that these two people at that stage, it just said a 21-year-old and a 20-year-old were in hospital. It was only about 15 minutes after I'd got into the office at my friend and colleague that I work for, by sheer coincidence, was Robert's uncle, rang me to tell me exactly who was involved in this incident, what had happened, and obviously sent some photographs as well to the newspaper. When we got the pictures through, I immediately recognised Sophie, which is a bit of a scary situation. List, you can tend to be remote from an awful lot of things that go on, even though they're horrific, even though they hurt you. You don't know, and you can't associate the person with the person because they're somebody whom you don't know. But when you see a photograph and you go, "Oh my God, I remember seeing her. I remember seeing her in Bacup. She was walking." And when I worked out where I'd actually seen her, she was very obviously walking back to her house on King Street. And that made it all the more shocking because I can remember I had my children with me. And isn't she beautiful? Oh, Sophie. She was quite a vision with beautiful, beautiful long black clothes, dreadlocked hair. It had the green braid tied in it at the time. And you really did turn your head, stop and say, wow. So to realise that was that person that night who had attacked was really quite shocking.
Now from there, from having access to Robert Maltby's uncle, Nigel Lancashire, what other information did you have and that other people didn't have in terms of their relationship? You talk about they were living together. So tell us what you did learn from the uncle about in terms of their relationship.
Well, he explained a lot about Sophie and Rob, about the fact that they had adopted a sort of gothic type lifestyle. That was the way the people that they were. They were quite independent, quite different, happy, and obviously very much in love. At that time, Sophie wasn't working. She was in between. She was working out what she wanted to do, and she was looking to go back to college. Rob was working at a local firm so that they could afford to pay for the flat that they shared together. They sounded like a couple who'd really found each other. They'd found the right person to be with. And what Nigel was able to have, they had a fantastic relationship. And both Nigel and his wife were good friends with both Sophie and Rob. It seemed such a tragic thing to happen to someone who was obviously in such a good place at the time.
Now, just for the record, not that it matters at all, but it for people to just to sort of wrap their head around this, again, you talk about how beautiful Sophie was, and sure, the photos clearly demonstrate that in the book as well. And then she had these dreadlocks, again, looked great, and then had this ribbon coiled through there, and she had some piercings. But tell us what Robert Maltby, just for the record, looked like as well, you know, because this will be important when we talk about people being attacked for looking differently. So how much differently did Robert, he really look?
Robert, again, was quite tall. He had dark hair that was quite, I think his hair varied. Sometimes it was dyed red, sometimes it was dark. And again, his hair was quite long in comparison to maybe most people. And he had retainers in his ears, which obviously form a hole between the earlobe and the main part of the ear. And they both looked quite different. They both had, obviously, they were following a certain gothic style, quite different to what you would see within the Bay Area.
The relationship they had, let's talk about, again, I asked this question, but it's sort of in my mind, I think the audience would ask too, what was the prevalence of occurrences of gang activity or major assault in this Double E Park prior to this incident?
Double E Park had become a bit of a teenage haunt on an evening. On the rare occasion that I'd been there, bear in mind I'm obviously considerably older than the teenagers who would hang out, I would see a lot of older kids. There was a gang culture in Bacup. They'd got this Bacup terror group, which was a bit bizarre, but they would slogan the town centre with BTG, and they would almost, it seemed like there was sort of fights being picked between different areas as well. Although Rossendale is all one area regarding local council and MP, it is very split, and people from Whitworth areas would sort of be pitting against each other. There had been at that time a youth project which was started within the Pennine Road area, which was originally a council estate, and that had been to instill belonging to people who were living as an offshoot of that, the youth project, where they made a video, and one of the people involved in the Sophie case was on that video. It did seem a little bit like it was a video for the gang rather than necessarily a video for the project, but it was a way the people did it. It was a way of getting your people engaged. The missions that were taken in that video go down, and brandishing wooden sticks in what could only really be described as a bit of a menacing manner.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you talk about the rap video with the wood sticks and the menacing manner, and again, this is supposed to be a community project video. It's very kind of, well, to say the least, odd. Let's talk a little bit about Sophie's mother, Sylvia, and sort of the relationship that she had and her family. Despite this alternative lifestyle, how accepted was it from her family?
Sylvia accepted Sophie's decisions with ease. She was quite happy with her daughter's choices. It was entirely up to her daughter what she decided to do. At 6 years old, Sophie decided that she wasn't eating and became a vegetarian. So you kind of got an idea that this was somebody who knew their own mind from a very young age. She then took to having her hair dyed black and having wearing long black trench coats, dark coats. And obviously this Gothic style was already coming out at a young age. But for Sylvia, she said, always said that she was really happy that her daughter was content within herself. I think that's something that you find with your children, that so long as they are content and they are happy, no matter what they choose to be or how they choose to be, that's what matters most of all.
Okay, now let's talk about the night in question. What time are we talking about? What were Robert and Sophie doing? And before they got to the park, tell us the circumstances surrounding them, what their decisions that evening. Tell us about that.
Well, Robert and Sophie had been out for the night. They'd been out at a friend's house. Nothing unusual about that. Yes, there'd have been some alcohol consumed, a massive amount. Walked from this friend's house, which was on the outskirts of Bacup, towards their own home, which was in the right slap bang centre in the town centre. They started walking, and for some reason, I did. This was probably just after midnight. For some reason, they decided that they cigarettes, obviously, they must have run out. So they went to what would have been the only place open at the time, which was like a service station attached to a petrol station. They went there to get the cigarettes, and that's where they met the first group of people. They were young youths. We don't know specifically how old they were, but they were chatting to Sophie and Rob, and they were quite fascinated with their appearance because they did look different to what would be considered the norm. And so, obviously, they drew quite a lot of attention. Sophie and Rob were sharing those cigarettes out between these young people, and by all accounts, they seemed quite friendly. At that time, one person who was within that group said something on the grounds of that they didn't feel happy or didn't feel confident being around Sophie and Rob. That was because their appearance was so different. They were uncertain, I don't know, but that they didn't feel right, want to be there. A precursor to maybe what went on. Once they then moved on from the petrol station to an area near the park where more youths were congregating. And then for some reason, which I really understood, they moved and walked into the park with some of those young people. Once they got to the skate park, they were being photographed. There was by all accounts, some of the young people in the park were photographing Sophie because obviously she looked so different to them. Also, as well as the gang of five who were subsequently charged with this murder and assault, there was a number of other young people in that park at the time, and they flocked around Sophie and Rob because they found fascinating, interesting. Who wouldn't? They looked completely different to the other young people. Sophie, especially with all the piercings, which would probably have been quite definitely unusual to the young people that were there. That's when it all changed. That's when the assault started.
Now, how was the assault initiated? I mean, again, you just paint this picture of sort of no provocation whatsoever. These people are 21 years old, and there's people ranging from 14 maybe to 17, 18 years old. But we're talking about like 1 a.m. So
yeah.
And what, and like you say, maybe some alcohol, maybe somebody was smoking marijuana. I don't know if there was any evidence of that, but it seems like an innocent situation. There doesn't seem to be any major history of any gang swarming of anybody attacking people. So from the information that you have, what initiated this assault on Robert Maltby?
Well, there's two. Somebody said something on the lines of, he's a mosher, let's bang him. That expression was definitely used, leading to the hate crime, leading to the attack, because they're different. There was also, I believe, because the people that we were talking about who started this attack, I believe it's possible that there was a degree of jealousy. Sophie and Rob had walked into their territory. This was their patch. This skate park at that time of night was their area. And suddenly somebody'd walked in who was more interesting than them. And I know it sounds basic to say jealousy, but I believe there was a degree of jealousy as well. The actual expressions used were the fact that there was a they were mocking the street name for a goth, bang 'em. And so it went on. And so the attack started initially on Rob. Rob was punched, kicked, hit, stamped to the ground. Once he was actually on the ground, they then proceeded kicking and stabbing his body. It was absolutely horrendous assault. Then once Rob was lying on the ground, from eyewitness statements, Sophie then cradled head in her lap. I'm guessing she was maybe shouting at them or telling, you know. And while she was on the ground, they then set about attacking her. Bear in mind, this is a very petite, tiny, tiny young thing. And to have attacked her in the way and the manner that they did, there could only have been one outcome. While all this was happening, some of the young people in the park that didn't scatter, that didn't run away, tried their best to try and stop this assault happening. They pulled at the attackers, and in court, the attackers could not explain why they'd had handprints at the tops of their shoulders and their arms. And the reason that was because people were trying to pull them off to stop them doing what they were doing. They made emergency phone. They desperately tried to get help and finally fled. They then tried to help both Sophie and Rob. Sadly, obviously, what had happened to Sophie was too severe. But they did their very best for those people that, to be honest, they didn't even know. They didn't know who they were. They just had happened.
Yes, you read about the considerable risk that these young people did, and it's encouraging this story too, that they did that, because there's so many stories of the exact opposite response in a case like that. Like, I wouldn't want to rat on my friends, or I didn't know what to do. These people did take considerable action and called the emergency services. And as you chronicle in your book, it's very heartbreaking that they're actually on the line with emergency services that, and I'll get you to explain this right away, they seem seemingly confused where to go, and who knows if the ambulance would have, getting to the scene quicker would have helped at all, but they were actually being attacked still while these brave young kids were on the phone with the emergency services.
Well, the first call is made from Park Road, the area where the kids had congregated before they came into the park. That first call, when that's made, they've obviously left the scene. They've made the call from away, so they mention the word Park Road because it was where they were. But they do say clearly that the attack is taking place in Baycup Park. Now, if you use a GPS system and you're not local, you would type in the word Baycup Park and you would get nothing. It doesn't exist. It's a generic name that people use here. It's a colloquial name. It's the one that everybody uses, but it's not the specific name. It's not the proper name. The proper name is Stubberley. So then if you think, well, Baycup Park doesn't work, let's type in Park Road. that there's loads in every single town, city, and there's a lot in Rossendale. So you've got those little bits of information going to somebody who isn't local, because no control centres are local anymore. Add to that, the second phone call is then made from inside the park. While that second phone call made by the girl is being made, you can actually hear the attack going on in the background. It can only be the attack, because you can hear someone basically shouting, "Get the off him." You can hear others shouting, "What are you doing?" You can feel the atmosphere behind the written word. You can actually physically see what's going on. So you have got a girl scared out of her wits, 14 years old, on a phone, trying to get help for these two people she doesn't even know. She hasn't got a clue who they are, how old they are. All she knows is they've been beaten within an inch of their lives, and it's wrong. She says on the phone, "Oh God, I better not get into trouble for this. That's someone who is petrified. So he goes, "Where's the ambulance? Where's the ambulance call?" 15-year-old boy makes a second phone call in the park. You've got the girl on the phone and the boy on the phone at the same time. The attackers are still in the area. They could have been victims 3 and 4 very easily. The girl is to walk, see what condition Rob is. All you can hear, all you can read in the background was, "What are you doing?" There's only one person that can be directed at. It's directed at that girl. What is terrifying in this is how could so easily have been a much worse situation, horrific as it is. All the time, the girl and the boy are saying the words, where's the ambulance? What's happening? Where are they? What are they doing? 14 minutes this phone call lasts. 14 minutes. The ambulance is dispatched, but the ambulance is dispatched almost as soon as the first call is made. So why does it take 14 minutes to drive a mile? I can walk it faster. I did. I tried. So I'm wondering, I'm going through these notes. Bear in mind, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, because I could write it easier then. For some reason, when everybody was gone to bed and quiet, I could write better. So I'm writing this at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I start to read the copy, and I'm going, why is this? The transcript, the same thing again and again and again. Now, Waterfoot is another town. It's about 3 miles from Bacup. It's another town with another park, on Park Road, with a skate park. So you've got so many similarities there to what the original call was. Assault in a park, on Park Road. But the assault was in Bacup Park. Unfortunately, that information was given correctly to the ambulance personnel. I did try to find out off the ambulance if they'd gone to the wrong in the wrong direction, and I got 2 replies saying that they didn't. I never ever got an explanation as to why it took 14 minutes to go a mile. I spoke to the police, who immediately said, yes, we went to the wrong park. We went off the information we were given from the ambulance service, and we went to Park Road, Waterfoot. I don't think that needs any further explanation.
Right. Now, emergency people arrive. Of course, the perpetrators are not there, and they take them to the hospital. The police, you write that they don't believe it's that serious, or they're going to be able to recover and give some kind of descriptions of the people. So how do police proceed? What happens at the hospital in terms of the health of Sophie and Robert?
Well, Sophie and Robert were initially taken to Rochdale. Rob was kept in there, but Sophie was more serious and was transferred. Rob ended up being transferred to North Manchester General, where a good friend of mine was actually a nurse looking after him. Rob was... She was crazy and disoriented. he was not in a good place. He was very confused, very mixed up, didn't understand what had gone on. Sophie was in a much, much more serious situation, and she was transferred to Hope Hospital. She was on a life support machine, although initially the police thought that they would both recover. They were very, very seriously injured. She unfortunately was only managed to be kept alive for 13 days, and after day 11 it was obvious that she unfortunately was not going to make it. I was informed, obviously, by Nigel that this was what was going to happen, and Rob was invited to go in and see Sophie for one last time before the life support machine was turned off. Jeez. At that time, we didn't know Sylvia at all. We didn't know family members. The police, understandably in these situations, tend to tell the family not to leave the press, not to with the press, just go through a family liaison officer issue statements. So at this time, apart from our own personal contact with Nigel, we didn't have any link to the family. It must have been absolutely horrendous, not just for Sylvia, but Adam, absolutely. Just a living hell.
Yeah, it's an incredible situation, Robert having to go in and say so long. And again, you describe him as sort of a childlike and disoriented and clearly, you know, mentally and physically affected by this attack. Mm-hmm. And then this. What I wanted to ask was, when we talk about the injuries to Robert and Sophie, we did not, well, unfortunately, we should describe exactly the extent of the injuries. You even talk about part of Sophie's scalp being ripped from her head. So tell us about the injuries that caused the death of Sophie and the near death of Robert.
When they were attacked, they were kicked and stamped about the face, the head, the body. One described it as they volley kicked her head. That leaves a horrendous image in your mind. They said that they used like a ball. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever. The attack was sustained and continuous, and it makes you wonder if they even saw Sophie and Rob as people, because they attacked and hurt them so badly. There were trainer marks on Sophie's face. Quite clearly, you could see the star shape of the lace. Her face was very badly bruised. The photographs of that were issued by the family afterwards. Sophie's hair had been yanked and part was missing. It had to be stapled back by the doctors. It was absolutely some of the worst injuries that I think I've ever heard. When the ambulance paramedics arrived, both Sophie and Rob were in such a bad state. They'd been injured so much that they couldn't tell which was male and which was female. And the difference between the two, Rob much more than Sophie, so badly injured, they didn't know which was which.
So after this attack, obviously we talked about the 14-year-old witness and the 15-year-old witness, so it doesn't take too long before police hear about who the people are that are involved. So who do police first find out about information, and then who do they first approach, and what is the end result from that interview?
I think it was quite difficult for the police at first, because there is this, you don't split, you don't tell, you don't break the code. And so as a result, you are asking young people to do all of those things and to break the code, right, and to tell. Now, although they did have a good idea who'd done this pretty early on. The biggest problem is that you've also got a situation where you've got young people and they find it hard to talk to an older police officer. So the detective inspector, Dean Holden, who was in charge, and what a fantastic copper. He was absolutely superb to work with. He employed young, newly trained female police officers and young police officers who would be able to speak to the young people they were in. Not the same situation where you were dealing with a young person who was, you know, nervous to speak to the police officer. At the end of the day, that's what they are, whether they're a young police officer or one who's been in service for a long time. But that was a really clever initiative, and that's how they managed to extract the information. Who had done this was all around town by the neck, by morning. When I went to pick my son up from the after-school club, I was being told a lot in the park that day, an awful lot of what had happened. So everybody knew what had gone on, but it was difficult to get that information. They did have the names early on, and they'd already started making arrests by the Sunday.
Now, you talk about in the book, they talk about Joseph Hume and his interview where he denies any involvement, but they don't just speak to him once. So tell us about the interviews with Joseph Hume, and again, what do the police get out of that conversation with him, those interviews?
Right, I'll have to find that in detail because I would not want to get it wrong. So can you come back to me on that?
Sure, certainly. And just in general, we don't need those kinds of details.
To get wrong.
The police,
I think what you found with this. Go on.
Pardon me? Go ahead.
No.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18-plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On you. You ask your question, please.
Oh, okay. What I'm saying is, in general, the specifics of that are in the book in terms of there's multiple interviews. He makes three statements, Joseph. He talks about touching Rob's phone because that's one of the things that's part of one of the exhibits, part of the evidence, is Robert Maltby's phone. So he explains that he touched it, which, again, we'll explain later. Thinking ahead, that will explain his fingerprints being on that phone,
yes,
potentially. Now, his brother is Danny Hume, so there's two brothers involved, and the police speak to these guys, and also we have a gentleman named Herbert, and we have Harris. So Harris, Herbert, Danny Hume, Joseph Hume, and Daniel Mallett. So, again, who do police, what have they heard in terms of the ringleaders of this incident? It takes a while, as you say, because you've got to get through this youth culture and their oath of allegiance to each other. So tell us what information the police have and how they proceed with it.
At the start, it was quite clear that there were certainly Harris and Herbert were definitely ringleaders. Both had a reputation, both were known, both were very familiar. And both had actually carried out a very similar assault in the park not long before this incident. For they'd been given a youth referral order, which is in layman's terms a ticking off. Naughty boy. Okay, you're supposed to adhere to the youth referral order, but they very rarely go anywhere. So they had got form. Now, both Humes also had form, which was, although they never, there was another incident in a town in the village where they lived, where somebody was attacked, but they never pressed charges, so the case never got to court. However, it bore striking similarities to what happened in the park. The older brother, Joseph Hume, was also known. He was waiting trial for witness intimidation, and that trial never went ahead because, obviously, the murder trial, which it was at that stage, was more serious. So that case against him was never pursued. So you had got some, you'd heard of some of the names, you'd heard of some of their form, their history, but the one that was unusual was Daniel Mallett. He was not somebody that people had heard a lot about. He lived in a very nice area, and it was came as quite a surprise that he got off for some reason in Bay Cup. He had been at high school with Herbert, but it's not known whether or not they had any association, because none of the five, obviously the brothers, lived in the same house, but the others lived in completely different areas, in Bay Cup, in Stackstead, and in Shawforth. In Ewell, put all five together. For some reason, they were. As far as the police go, it was a difficult job. The only person that immediately went, hold hand up, was Mallett. But again, Mallett was not a ringleader. It went on. He held his hand up and admitted attacking Rob once. And then he said that was it. This isn't right. I'm not, you know, and step back. What went on and who actually did what, we'll never find out. And unfortunately, because of the nature, because Herbert had pleaded guilty, his evidence was never heard. And Harris, when he was in court on trial, basically blamed everything on Herbert.
Sure.
So the person that could have said what had happened, Herbert, never gave evidence. Whether he'd have told the truth or not, who knows? But the fact that it, for a kind of look in, you want to know. So you want to know what happened? What happened that night to cause this? And nobody actually told you, because the person that could have given that crucial bit of information had admitted his part in his guilt, so was just immediately out of the picture as far as the court case goes.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Danny Hume said he blamed the attack on Herbert, and of course he minimized his role. Obviously, he said he tried to save Sophie. Daniel Mallett is striking in the book. He cried in six interviews. Harris, again, just blamed everything on Herbert, and Herbert wouldn't talk.
Yeah.
At the same time, though, which is an astounding part of this book, at the same time this is happening, there is this movement occurring, and a slow, and you're involved with it as well. The Hume brothers and Mallett got bail while Harris and Herbert were confined, and you say their names couldn't be named in public because of their age, but everybody knew their name. Everybody knew who these people were. And with that, and with Sophie, and with the community, came an upswell of support and interest and basically outrage as well. So tell us about the movement that seemed to be forming at the same time around the murder of Sophie and the near murder of Robert Mulpey.
There was one drilled, and it was organised by a youth movement that Sophie had been involved with. They held a fundraiser, and that seemed to spark things. Suddenly, people were saying that this isn't right. It's wrong. What's gone on wrong? And these fundraisers just kept happening. They're in 2007, the plan. Fundraiser at the pub in Bay Cup. I knew that I'd covered obviously stories about the fact that this fundraiser was going to take place, and I'd written stories in the paper, and I'd gone out to meet the people involved, and I went to the event itself, which is not my thing. I don't do football, However, I went along because it seemed to be the right thing to do. The fundraiser was incredible. There'd been a song written, A Walk in the Park, by Cosmic Slop, one of the organisers of the event. And that song just resonated. It summed up everything that had happened. That was when we started making these ribbons, which were sold all over Rossendale. And that led me to being asked to go and interview Sylvia.
Now, with the, again, it's unprecedented and you're not supposed to get involved, and but you do speak with Sylvia, Sophie's mother, and again, this groundswell of support and interest, and like you say, these ribbons, and then later we get other merchandise that is being sold as fundraisers, and all kinds of other people get involved. Tell us about the media interest in this right from the beginning, and again, we'll talk about how the media interest stayed with this story, but tell us about the national and if international media interest at that time.
I was in Burnley Magistrates. That was when the first approach came from a lady who worked for a production, a TV production company. She was interested in doing some kind of documentary. Now, I've had these before, and you've kind of like, you've got to choose who you're going to talk to. Sometimes you've got to decide whether you're going to bother because you don't know where it's going to go. But to be fair, she did seem very genuine. So I took her around Bake Up, showed her what we were doing, showed her the area. Subsequent to that, I was contacted by a guy who was with Radio 4, and again, he wanted information on the town, where things had happened, so pretty similar. I met up with him. It was rather bizarre. I met up with him in a restaurant that I go to with my husband. Knew the restaurant owner incredibly well, walked in, and he automatically went, "Ah, you need this table over here, Catherine," and led me to the guy who was sitting having a meal. I explained to Mario, but he was a nice guy, so he a background piece for radio. And it's difficult. You have a situation where either you help the national media in a situation and you hope they get the story right, or you leave them to their own devices and know it pretty much, they may have an agenda. So you know, get involved and try and make sure that what this was genuine. It's just the way it worked. And then obviously somebody approached me about writing a book. So hence what's happened.
And Sylvia was obviously not, again, most people would advise against cooperating with the media. A lot of people would just sort of recoil or go into a shell and not want to be any type of public figure at all. Not that she was, not that she attended every concert or anything, but there was a support from Sylvia and basically supporters for everything that was, again, the sort of a concerted message of tolerance that, and so tell us about this sort of a concerted, everybody was on the same page in terms of being supportive for once of something that was going to come. Of course, everybody at a trial is going to hear the recounting of the assault itself, which is very, very difficult, and they couldn't even handle that. But tell us about sort of that solidarity that existed in this movement with some kind of common goals as the agenda.
I think whenever something horrific happens, you have two choices. You can, metaphorically speaking, sit and lick your wounds forever, or you can try and do something positive. In this case, it would do something positive. Then at least a horrendous reality of what happened, sometimes it can make it easier to do so. When I carried out that first interview, that was the first time she mentioned about the SOPHIE and the bans, and Stofi standing for Stamp Out Prejudice, Hatred and Intolerance Everywhere. and she told me about starting this charity. That evolved into what is now the Sophie Lancaster Foundation. But you'd see at that in those early days that this was giving Sylvia a focus, and I think it helped her to be able to concentrate on making that happen, and the fantastic success she's made of it now. So you could see in those early days that there was some, I hate to say the word good, but something positive was going to come out of what happened, and the tremendous work that's now being carried out has been supported by all and was being supported across Rosendale. And obviously not just this spread, getting information about things happening in America, things happening around the world, fundraisers for this same appeal, this little tiny place called Rosendale that nobody had ever heard of for any good reason. And no reason why anybody should have heard of Rosendale particularly. But it was a positive thing that was coming out. It's you're halfway to healing.
Now, part of the healing process, or maybe it's not, was the Harris's trial. And at that trial, you talk about it must have been a horrible experience. Again, I talked about how the families couldn't handle a lot of the details and left the courtroom. But it featured a 14-minute tape of the 14-year-old girl calling police during the attack. Tell us a little bit more about the Harris trial, and also, again, very dramatic, the photos were shown at a trial by the pathologist, Dr. Carter.
Yeah, the photographs went round. Obviously, at that stage, the pictures went to the jury, and they went to the prosecution, the defence, the judge. They didn't, at that time, go to the press. I was in the press bench on that day, and we made a written request from the press that were actually there asking if those pictures, if the family would give permission for those pictures to be released. Although we hadn't seen them, it was obvious they were quite crude case, but quite physically the damage that had been inflicted on these two defenseless people. Neither Sophie nor Rob they weren't fighters. They weren't people who picked a fight or tried to get involved in one and would walk away. They were passive. So they had basically just been attacked and kicked to the ground, and there was no defense. They didn't assault on these boys. And we knew that those pictures would be crucial in just showing to people how horrendous what had happened really was. We were told that the family had given approval that once the case was over, we could use them. When they were released, it was shocking, and people, the reaction was one of the complete disbelief that this could have been allowed to happen. My friend who had treated Rob in the hospital said to me that the photographs told a fraction of the true story, because she'd seen exactly what they both looked like before, and it was an awful lot worse than the images that were released, and the images that were released were horrific.
There was a lot of evidence, blood evidence on Herbert, for example, and we talked about Herbert and Harris being deemed the ringleaders, Mallet not very much at all, and then four were left that pled guilty to causing grievous bodily harm. That's in the case of Robert. But they did really concentrate on Harris and Herbert. So what were the sentences like? And before we get to the sentencing and the result of the trial, what was the demeanor? We kind of skipped over the preliminary where you talk about some of the behavior from the defendants. So talk about the defendants, the incident I mentioned at the preliminary with the Holm brothers, and just their overall demeanor at trial.
Well, there was a few incidents that happened. I was in court in December, and one of the relatives of one of the accused, his mobile phone went off. Now, everybody's had an incident where your mobile phone's gone off. So you go, and you can immediately silence it, and you never speak. But no, this person answered his phone while his son was on trial for murder and said, "Sorry, can't talk now, I'm in court." I was absolutely horrified that anybody would, and he was automatically reprimanded, but rather than switch it off, he then left it and it rang again. He was then told that if it rings a third time, you're out of court. Their attitude, the parents' attitude towards what had happened seemed very matter of fact. At one incident, one of the parents was laughing with their child waiting to go and speak to the police officers on the charge of murder. Another incident, a false alibi was given, and the officer had to say, "You don't change the evidence, do you?" Into the course of justice. I cannot believe that anyone would take something so serious so lightly. Words fail me on that. So in court, if that's the attitude of the parents, what is the attitude of the children? At sentencing, Herbert emotions that air out the judge. They were totally stony-faced, didn't seem bothered. Hume, likewise. Danny Hume didn't seem bothered. The only person that really, really seemed worried and scared was Danny Mallett. And he was biting his nails and looked, to all intents and purposes, like a little child.
What was the reaction in the courtroom? What was the mood like in the courtroom? What was the dynamic like?
When it came to sentencing or at the end of the trial?
End of the trial.
At the end of the trial, it was sheer relief when the jury came back and said guilty. You know in your heart of hearts, how can you possibly not say guilty, but you don't know that they're going to. Mm. And there is always that element of doubt. And there was absolute relief. There was a you could hear the relief as soon as they said guilty. Thank goodness.
Now, what were the sentences like? We talk about, you know, truth in sentencing. Did the judge impose? Did the jury recommend? Tell us how that works, and what kind of sentences did they get for Herbert and Harris?
Herbert was given 18 years. Herbert had said, "I didn't do anything," and Herbert had been proved wrong. He had been one of the ringleaders. That was a lot for sentencing anybody. Indeed, an adult for that same crime, bear in mind 15. He was only 15 at the time of the incident. Herbert, because obviously he'd pleaded guilty when he ran out of defences, he was given initially 16 years, I think it was 16 years, right. 3 months, and that was reduced slightly on appeal. Then you had the three who were only convicted of the attack on Rob. The Hume brothers both got 5 years, 10 months, and Biggie'd got an early plea. Danny, he'd expressed his intention to plea early. Danny Mallett got 4 years, 4 months. All three are now. Have now been released.
It is an indication of a very successful prosecution in terms of, you explain as well, that Herbert got 16, and these are indefinite. It could be 16 to life, couldn't it? Could be 18
it
years
be.
To life. It's not automatic that they're going to get out.
They are minimum sentences.
Right. And also a very successful prosecution when you can take a minor and get them raised up to adult court, and then give them in adult court a very serious sentence as well. So it was an indicative of the prosecution, and especially when you see what you wrote about the judge. Tell us what the judge said, which again I've never. It's unusual.
He issued a 10-page sentencing. Ever seen a 10-page sentencing? From a journalist's point of view, it was absolute dynamite. He described the offenders as feral, acting like animals, but that's not fair because animals obviously are much better behaved than that. described it as a hate crime, which was the one thing that the family had been hoping was going to be said. And that's why the sentences were so severe, because he had viewed it as a hate crime. This was the thing that they'd been wanting to hear. He went into meticulous detail to justify why he had actually decided to give them such severe sentences. And he belt and braces boxed off everything. It was superb. From a journalist's point of view, it was incredible, because it gave us, there was so much to write about. And he also took time to praise those young people who made those calls, all of the officers and civilian job bringing to trial.
What I thought was profound was the judge said, you know, this talk of remorse from the defendants and the end here is hollow. And
yes.
You know, I couldn't believe I heard that, because that's the way I think. If you were remorseful, you wouldn't have laughed at the preliminary. You wouldn't have conducted yourself differently. Number one, you wouldn't attack somebody like a wild animal, worse than a wild animal. And now, so I was amazed with that.
He saw through very, very clearly that what they were saying was not the truth. He summed it up amazingly, and he did what the family wanted. He gave them the sentencing they wanted. Unfortunately, whether or not those other three should have been tried for murder, we'll never know.
Yes, in America it might have been a lot different than in the UK as well, in terms of their culpability. They got very light sentences. In America,
yeah,
I don't think they would have fared that well.
Not when you look, you weigh up the injuries that were on Rob.
He
was, you know, severely, severely beaten.
Mm-hmm. Well, in America, I believe, and I'm not a legal expert in all American states, but I would believe that I would put money on that all five of these people would have been convicted for their part
in this
savage murder.
They did originally want to go for a joint enterprise prosecution, and the original papers, that was what they were going to pursue. It was only after they got Harris, after Herbert decided to plead guilty, because that took out one key player to have given evidence, and you left with just the evidence of the young people, which I don't think they viewed strongly enough to be able to get a conviction on them, the other three.
Yeah, and I think they would have been correct with that, according to your book too, that there would have been two.
Yeah, well, especially as now it's been on a higher court, it started to overturn some of the enterprise verdicts. They're all being reviewed now. If the situation had happened that they'd been convicted of joint enterprise, and after so many years now, we're 9 years after the attack, suddenly they'd all been back in court appealing, and they'd in effect not got off with it, but their sentence had been lessened. That would have been even harder for the family to face, I think.
Yes, that's a great point, because that would have been just horrible to go through it again, regardless of any reassurances or assurances that it would get the same verdict. That would just be horrible to go. Once was enough, you know.
Yeah.
Wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Now, with this again, the bright spot of this book, it's, if there is any, and there is, an incredible sort of brightness to this book. Sylvia met with Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and the Sophie Lancaster Foundation is an umbrella organization. You say encompasses media training, education, work with youth, raising awareness. And you say Sophie groups sprang up throughout the world, and people have contacted Sylvia. So tell us more about the Gothic Sophie logo, and just tell us a little bit more about what has happened with this organization after this trial and after meeting with Gordon Brown. Where is the Sophie Lancaster Foundation today?
The work that's been done in those 9 years is quite amazing, quite incredible. Sylvia is often called upon to comment as almost like a when there's incidents, because she's obviously got such intense personal experience of this, but also the foundation is starting to build bridges. It's working in schools, often primary schools, but also high schools and colleges, and it's tackling that prejudice head on, looking at the way children perceive other children, adults perceive other adults, and trying to break down those barriers. Because somebody looks different doesn't mean that they should be treated differently. Not just that, it's making inroads. Police have their view of hate. Their reporting of hate crime has changed. You are now entitled to say, I am a goth, I follow, I shouldn't be attacked just because I am. No sooner had this been introduced in Manchester than someone was arrested very soon after because the person had said they were gothic. So they are making a big difference. It's important because that, I think, gives both Sylvia the knowledge that something positive has come out of it, but it also it gives that sense of worth that, Sophie, this happened, but look what has come out of it. It's very sad that a lot of children in primary schools locally don't seem to have heard about what happened to Sophie. And I've been in doing anti-bullying sessions, and often I will use what happened to Sophie to challenge the children to think how they would react to somebody who looked differently, to challenge them to think how they could perceived, what about them is different to maybe somebody else in the class, and then to think how sometimes people pick on that and why it's wrong. They were very successful, the ones that I did. They're just stopping and making pupils think before they go to high school and somebody a name without potential consequences. The Sophie Foundation has done so much good work. That's Sophie logo that you were talking about, I actually face painted that on somebody's head once, and it was an amazing thing to do. I took a photograph of it to Sylvia, and she thought somebody had it tattooed on his forehead.
Yeah,
did explain that it was actually on his face, so it wasn't that long lying. But there's a lot of people done that. There's a lot of people. And had that Sophie Gothic logo tattooed on their body. There's so many people who have contacted me from all over who've read the book and want to just talk about it because they've got their own experience. There's a lady I liaise with regularly in Portugal. She suffers a lot of prejudice. There's a goth out in Canada, Richard. I speak to him on a regular basis, and he suffers. He's I'm trying to remember now, 60, I think 62, and he suffers prejudice because of who he is. Still there. Sadly, it's still going on.
In January 2009, you wrote in a book that the Sophie Lancaster Foundation entered the political arena with an attempt at a widening of hate crime legislation. Very interesting as well.
They did try to get, they had an early day motion, but it didn't actually progress much. Obviously, in 2010, so the target now is more the police to change the way hate crimes reported.
Excellent. Also, you do mention, just for people that may look into, will be motivated to look into this a little bit more, there was a documentary, Killer Kids, the Sophie Lancaster documentary, and another book called Black Roses, The Killing of Sophie Lancaster. It's 29 pages of poetry, and you tell us about both those projects and why you felt that they were, you know, a reasonable addition to this book.
Killer Kids, I wasn't so keen on. I wasn't happy with the way it interpreted the story. There's a lot more to this story than just two people being attacked. There's a lot more. And I also, but Black Roses, I think, is the most incredible piece of poetry I've ever, ever read in my life. Yet that book is so short, and yet with every single rhyme, with every phrase, with every cleverly constructed sentence, it portrays an image that is lasting, made into a drama documentary with the actress walking around us, Sophie, reciting the poem, just recounting her story. And it was first a radio play and then made into a drama documentary on TV, and also it was a stage production. And I have to say, it was one of the most powerful things I think I've ever seen.
Wow, that's Black Roses. That's incredible. The other thing, too, is which I thought was, which was fitting for Sophie, was the, of course, the British band The Damned played on what would have been Sophie's 22nd birthday. And it was called Stamp Out Prejudice, Hatred and Intolerance Everywhere. That was a big gig, and 22 black helium balloons were released at that concert.
I was there. It was quite amazing to see. And I must admit, Captain Sensible, I've always liked Captain Sensible. When he got up to play on stage, and there was the Sophie band, I managed to get a photograph of him with the Sophie band on his wrist. And he was absolutely brilliant. He just stole the show. And when they released the balloons outside, it was really quite moving.
Yes, that's, you really did capture that, too. That was amazing. Basically, I guess I'm going to ask this last question before I let you go, and I guess it's an obvious question, but how affected were you by doing this story? I mean, of all the things that you've done, all the cases that you've covered, tell us what the effect of this case was for you as a journalist and a person.
Well, a couple of years, I'm going to have been a journalist for 30 years, which sounds scary. In the time I've covered an awful lot of things, I've been affected. I've walked away from nearly all of them. But for some reason, I got involved with this. And I think my only reason for that is that because it was very close to home. I've got children. We go to that park. That's somewhere I know very well. Albeit I only saw her once, but I saw Sophie, and I remember seeing Sophie. And it should never have happened. It was wrong, completely and utterly wrong. And I suppose that's why I got involved, because I was angry. As a journalist, you are supposed to just report what goes on and not get involved. And I did get ticked off at times. I've had people say, "Oh, you didn't do all that." Well, I only reported what really went on, and I only did things because I wanted to try and make a bit of a difference. And if we kick-started some campaign and it's gone, things, and that's what mattered. It mattered for all the people making those ribbons that they were doing something. People wanted to channel their energies into doing something because they were very, very angry. And if I was a means to that end, good. As a reporter, my editor was right. I am supposed to just write what happens, not get involved. But then I'm a person too. I couldn't just stand back and do that. And if that was wrong, then I'm wrong.
No, you were absolutely right in becoming so involved. And with it, you brought the reporting. Again, you reported so many articles. That's how Sylvia was convinced that you were the right person to speak to. And then it wasn't like she was going to speak to everybody. So the one person that she was going to speak to And you captured this story eloquently and incredibly. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about the Sophie Lancaster story. For those people that might want to look at your other work or contact you, or do you do Facebook websites? Tell us a little bit about that, if that, anything.
Yeah, there's a Facebook group for anybody who's read the book who wants to discuss anything or any aspect. That's just quite literally Sophie Lancaster book. Obviously, the book's for sale through R.J. Parker Publishing on Amazon. I've been quite staggered at how it's gone. It republished. He just happened to have reviewed it on Amazon, and his daughter has a goth friend who gets a bit of a hard time, and what happened was he gave her a copy of my book. She read it, asked how it was doing. He checked up and found it wasn't selling, and approached me because we'd contacted each other through Facebook once he reviewed my book, and he offered to republish it. I'm incredibly grateful because he's given Sophie's story a much wider audience, which is what matters at the end of the day. What happened shouldn't ever be forgotten, but what good came out of it also shouldn't ever be forgotten. Because if a story is just doom and gloom, then it's not a story. What's happened as a result is positive, it's making a difference, and it's important that people know that.
Absolutely. I have to say that I had no idea of this story, so thanks to this new publishing, I'm aware of this story. So again, and nobody can be up on all of the stories because there's so many that are competing, but a story like this really cuts through all of the other ordinary stories to be one of the more incredible cases and stories, and again, a little bit of a happy ending, if there can be such a thing after a disaster like this. But I want to thank you very much for coming on, Catherine Smythe, and talking about the Sophie Lancaster story. Thank you very much, and you have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.